Okay, it is 3:30. I know you've had a long day, and this is the conclusion before a good break. So yesterday we had a wonderful time talking about recovery ministry and just the power of addiction and the power of the Christian faith in helping us to overcome that. You got to hear some great stories from my friends Ed and Barbara Bice about their life and about starting of this ministry. Today we want to get into some nuts and bolts about how to form this kind of ministry at your church. You'll get a good handout at the end with everything in it. But I want to start back with just inspiration of what we're trying to give people, which is hope. And as we mentioned yesterday, Barbara's written a book that's just excellent. If you'd like to purchase one afterwards, get their signatures, and you have that chance today. But I want her to read a chapter that's entitled Hope from her book to get started.
Many years ago, I was asked by someone in our church to speak at one of our ladies' retreats. Before then, I had never stood up before a large group of people and shared my story. I was so nervous. We met in a large banquet room. We were served a wonderful meal, and then it came time for me to speak. I remember I could hardly hear myself think for my heart pounding in my chest. I did the best I could at the time, but back then, the pain of everything was still pretty fresh. I'm afraid I might have vented more than I testified. What I really want to tell you is not about my testimony that night, but about what happened afterwards. All of us women gathered in a room where the chairs were set up in a large circle. When we entered the room, each woman was handed an unlit candle. As soon as we were all seated, someone turned out the power, and it was pitch black. After a few minutes, the leader of the group lit her small candle. Even with her candle lit, you could barely just see her face. Then our session began. She talked about what a dark, dark world we would live in if we didn't have hope. She spoke of the importance of sharing our faith, hope, and strength with others. She then stood up, walked across the room to another woman, and said to her, "I will never forget the night you came to my house and prayed with me after hearing my diagnosis. You had walked in my shoes before. You had felt my fear. You were cancer-free then, and you gave me hope." When she finished speaking, she lit the woman's candle, and she went and she sat down. The room became a tad bit brighter. The woman whose candle she lit then stood up and walked across the room to another woman much older than her, and she said, "Thank you for mentoring to me when I was just a young wife and mother. You shared your experience with me. You taught me about love and about patience. You made me a better wife to my husband and a better mama to my little girl." She then lit the woman's candle with her candle, and the room became a tad bit brighter. The older woman then took her candle and walked over to another woman and said, "All of the cards and telephone calls from you when my husband was terminally ill gave me strength to get through each day. I love and thank you for that." She lit the woman's candle, and the room became a little brighter. You see where all this is going. Each woman, time and time again, took her candle that was lit by someone she encouraged, and she in turn lit the candle of someone who had encouraged her. When it was all said and done, the room was so bright from the candles that it looked as though the power had been turned back on. And in fact, it had been. The power of faith, the power of hope, and the power of love. I cannot stress enough the importance of hope when you are dealing with addiction. I know what hopelessness feels like, and I know what hopelessness looks like. I've seen it in the eyes of mothers, fathers, husbands, wives, siblings, and friends. I do not claim to be an expert on addiction, but one thing that I know for certain and have come to believe is that there is always hope. I'm not saying that every addict or alcoholic turns into a success story, because sadly that's not the case, but we should never lose hope for them, and we should never lose hope for ourselves. There are people I know and love who still struggle with addiction. It is my most fervent prayer that those still active in addiction will find help and never lose hope. But it's also my prayer that those of us who love and lose friends and family members to addiction, sometimes even to the point of death, know that there is still hope. Today my hope is in God. Though life does not always go the way we want, He is faithful to help us through our most difficult situations and our most heartbreaking times. Remember that no matter what we go through on this earth, it is only temporary. I've lived long enough to know that life is not fair, and there will always be questions that we may not have the answers to this side of heaven. It took me a long time to accept that, but eventually I did. I know today that God never leaves me or forsakes me, and that no matter what troubles or heartaches that we face on this earth, they're only temporary, for He tells us that our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us eternal glory that far outweigh them all. Remember that we are all on a journey home. I pray that you never give up, that you never lose hope, and may we all light someone's candle along the way.
That's just one wonderful chapter, many chapters that would really touch your heart. I encourage you to not only buy the book, but maybe buy a few so you can give out to people. Because it gives a lot of hope. Yes, sir.
What's the name of the book?
What's that?
What's the name of the book?
It is called Just Right, which is Ed's saying, if you ever ask him how he's doing, Just Right. Mm-hmm. How are you doing, Ed?
Just Right.
Just Right. Okay.
Who's the author?
She's the author. She's Barbara's author. Yeah.
Barbara who?
Barbara Bice, B-I-C-E. We've got the books here. So you can get those. Thank you, Matt. Now I'm going to get a little practical, and I'm going to share just a little bit, and then Barbara and Ed are going to share quite a bit about this ministry. And again, you'll get a full handout of this. What we are trying to give is hope, you know. I mean, there's so many, not just addicts, but their families. And Barbara will address later how we try to deal with the entire family and not just the addict. That we're trying to give some a great degree of hope. And so I would just say to you, in our church, this ministry has changed the face of our church. It's changed the look of our church. It's changed the feel of our church. We have two different services. One service we intentionally dress down. I normally change into jeans to preach in that service. It's held in our gymnasium. It's in the round. And that's been a really great thing for a lot of our younger people, but a lot of our people that are coming to our recovery ministry, because it doesn't seem as churchy. It doesn't seem as formal. And I think that's been a big deal. I think having an atmosphere of confession and openness gives everybody hope. Using as many testimonies as possible in your services. I think we underrate the power of a good testimony. I think a short testimony is worth more than a long sermon. Don't say I said that. All right, a short testimony, it just is. It's what touches people. And whether you're talking about this issue or another issue. And we purposely had so many addiction testimonies for years that we've also just tried to mix in some testimonies of people who just got their marriage together or people just raising their children right. So every story doesn't have to be some wild and crazy story. But, you know, boy, when people start getting open about this issue, it opens the door for people to be open about other issues. So I'm just going to share with you some of the things that Ed and Barbara have said for starting recovery class. And this will be, again, you'll receive this. The first key is to pray. I mean, I know our shepherds prayed long and hard about this. Pray for wisdom and discernment of how to start this. Pray about the leaders of this class. This is the great thing to me about support group movement in our country is God uses, you know, our biggest mess for our biggest opportunity in ministry. Mm-hmm. I remember being in a group of ministers once, and, you know, everybody was asked, what prepared you for ministry? And 95% of what they shared was not about some theological school or some book they had read. It was about the worst messes in their life that had prepared them to be compassionate. So to start this ministry, the blessing we had is people who have been through this. You know, Ed is, obviously, you heard the story yesterday. That's the person prepared to lead this ministry. We started a depression ministry. We've used people who've struggled and overcome depression. We started a ministry of same-sex, people with same-sex attraction. Obviously, you want to use people who've been through that journey who can now help with that. And so that's critical. The man that helps Ed with this, and sort of a secondary man, is a man named Tim Lee. And Tim's addiction had been gambling. So it was quite different, but it allowed them to be a great match in leading that. So just pray for God to reveal who needs to lead this, and pray for God to send people from within your church and outside your church. Make sure that the leaders are supported. I mean, you want 100% buy-in from the shepherds of your church. I mean, you know, when you open the door for this kind of ministry, you open the door for a lot of problems. A lot of our churches don't like being too messy. I don't know of any church that's real that isn't messy. And so you've got to have buy-in from the leadership. got to be something that's mentioned quite often and encouraged and celebrated. Have a specific time each week. Our typical overcomers class is for an hour. And they mentioned yesterday, we started off on a Monday or Tuesday night. But we've shifted a decade ago to Wednesday night. Because we try really hard to integrate this ministry in our church. We don't want to be a separate sidelight. And so them being there on Wednesday night, number one, made them feel more part of our church. Second is we had immediate child care. And that was a great blessing. Because when you have people trying to come and they can't necessarily have child care for their children, that can turn into a mess. And then you develop a format. And in just a moment, Ed's going to get up and talk about the format of the weekly meeting that they pretty much stick to every week. And it really, really works, you know. Again, we're not trying to take the place of a small AA meeting. We're trying to create a spiritual environment where tools are given. And I know people are encouraged to go that way. Establish good guidelines. I mean, this is something you have to really reiterate over and over. And here's some of the guidelines that are given in our overcomers meeting. Confidentiality. I can say that I attend the class, but I cannot say that you attend the class. Okay? People don't go out and say, "Well, we believe who showed up tonight." You can say that, and you confess your own sins, not somebody else's sins in the class. And what stays in, what descends in the room stays in the room. Treat each other with love and respect. That's so critical. You know, you want a judgmental spirit. Yes, sir.
What would be a member of the church who's comes in the church drunk? What would you?
Ed, what do you do when you have a member of the church comes in drunk?
So
we've dealt with that.
What would he do with some of that? I mean, I couldn't call the police because the guy's been in jail constantly.
We have never had that. We haven't come in using before, and we just ask that they do not share. They're welcome. And if they get rowdy, a couple of us will take them outside and talk to them. But, you know, we welcome whether they're drinking or whether they're not. But we ask them not to share during the meeting the first time. In fact, I'll read that to you just to.
Yeah, that's part of the guidelines, isn't it? You know, you must have a commitment to honesty. And you got to maintain an attitude of encouragement. I mean, when you have an open meeting like Ed's been describing to you, it can be, you know, almost sabotaged by someone who just wants to take the floor and vent. But these guidelines help that not to happen. And one of the guidelines that Ed just mentioned is ask that anyone who's been sober less than 24 hours not share, but only listen. I think there's some things they've learned over time that can be very helpful. You know, you want to get word out. We've advertised in local magazines, but I think the best thing that happens is our membership is bought into this as being a big part of our DNA. It's such a blessing when you have a friend or you meet a family that has a child who's struggling with these issues. You know, we all have someone to point to. We really have become, our reputation in Montgomery. And someone said this to me the other day, I didn't really know this. He said, "You do know Landmark's reputation in Montgomery is that's the recovery church. If you've got a big problem, that's where you can go." And that's exactly what we want it to be. So what we found out, though, the group, as they described yesterday, started off very small. It really exploded over time. And so, Ed, if you'd come now and talk about the meeting itself and what that looks like.
This is just a two-page. Can I talk loud enough? I don't need that microphone. Drink. Try it. If I don't get, they say I speak softly, so raise your hand, and I'll pick up the microphone if I need to. But in our meeting, what we do, we meet on Wednesday nights, and we want the people to feel a part of our church, and we welcome anybody. Something we started about 8 or 9 years ago, we had mentioned, is we started cooking too on Wednesday nights, and we cook and serve food from 5 to 6. We have 3 recovery houses in the area that come to this meeting. So we eat from 5 to 6 and fellowship from
from 6 to 6:30, and I'm meeting from 6:30 to 7:30, and we do offer child care. We found that it's something about eating with them. It's just something about sitting down at a table. It's about a relationship. You really get to know somebody a lot better when you're eating with them than when they're just coming to the meeting. And our door is open anytime to anybody. We start off our meeting, though, and I normally open it up, and this is just a format, and this may not work for every church, but I promise you this, if you need to cover in your church and you start a program and pray about it, the right program will come along. I mean, this may not work for you, but I think there'd be some similarities that you'll find that would work. We open up, and I welcome everybody to RSVP program, and we open with a word of prayer. And I'll just choose somebody in the class to open that prayer. It changes every week. Then that's what we normally say. We'll say this is not an RSVP meeting at Landmark. This is an open meeting. We have a clause in there for open or closed. We hadn't had a closed meeting in years. And I don't think we'll probably ever have another closed meeting. It's an open meeting. We say RSVP is a 12-step recovery program based on biblical and spiritual principles. We're not confused about who our higher power is. It is our Lord and our Savior, Jesus Christ. And this program is not intended to replace any other 12-step programs in your area, such as AA, NA, and GA. In fact, we strongly recommend that you find a group. If you've got an alcohol problem, we suggest you go to AA. This is not a single source. We believe in sponsorship. We believe in seeking out programs in your area. And we believe in working the 12 steps. And then we ask if anyone visiting was there for the first time, ask them to raise their hands and identify themselves. If no visitors are there, we go on. If they are this, we ask them, this is the first meeting that they attended. And if they say yes, we go into a newcomers meeting. That's what the topic. Tim will kind of shift gears. He'll go on with the devotion, but we'll go into a newcomers meeting. What we'll do then is I go ahead and read the rest of this. It says, never mind everyone, it's okay if me to tell someone that I attend this meeting, but cannot say that you attend this meeting. Remember to identify yourself each time you speak. You do not have to share in the class tonight. However you do choose to do so, everything you say needs to be the truth. If you've used in the last 24 hours, we ask that you do not share in the class tonight. Now, if someone comes in and they're intoxicated, we will normally talk to them before the meeting and tell them they're welcome. No outburst. They got to be in control. And if not, we have enough people at our meeting that a couple of us will take them outside and just talk to them and take them to the kitchen or something. We're really not here. We've had people come in and use them, but not just, we hadn't faced that problem yet. But it could come next week. Yes, sir.
How do you get more members to come?
Advertise and make sure.
We're a church of three. Well, over 1,000 now. When we started the program, about 300. And I think one of the reasons the elders asked us to start this meeting, they never shared that with us. We just assumed that there was probably some members in our church that had been talking to elders, and they know the problem existed. We had a very slow start for the first 2 years. The college was on Monday, but after we started the Wednesday night program, we did connect with a couple of recovery houses, and they would bring people in and just grew from there. I think the most we've ever had in our class is around 80, and I'll be honest with you, that's too many. That's too big. We're from about 35 low when people are traveling. 35 to 40 is a normal night, but the low night, and we'll have anywhere from 45 to 60 people in that range, 55, 58 people in our meeting. We ask you if you use the last 24 hours, we ask you not to share in class tonight. And we'll have three readings. We'll have somebody get up and read the
12 steps of recovery, and ours just a little bit different. I'll go over them with y'all in just a little bit. And then we're going to read the promises, and then we're going to read our mission statement. And we've not always read that mission statement, but we're going to start back and reading it. It just clarifies a few things. And in fact, when I get to that, I'm going to ask Barbara just to read that in just a few minutes. And then after they get up and they read, then Big Tim Lee, he's one of the most awesome guys. Me and Tim started in 2002, our first meeting, and I love that man. He's a giant of a man, and he got the biggest heart, and he does a devotion, and he is awesome. He can take a step and convert it, and I mean, he can bring you to tears. He's just a special, special, humble man. He'll do that, and he always has a song. We have one song, and the devotion normally lasts about 5 to 8 minutes. A song will last 2 to 3 minutes, 4 minutes. And we try by 5 minutes till 7 to open the meeting up. And then we'll have approximately 30 minutes share time. And you're welcome to share on anything you want to. We're going to have a topic. It's going to either be a spiritual, or it's going to be a step, or it's going to be something, you know, character defect or something concerned with recovery. And then we're going to be an open meeting. And now, if it's a newcomer meeting, that's when we start off. And then there's a core group in there of people who've got some experience, and then they will share their first meeting, and they'll just share. And we just kind of know what we do. Not saying that's what you need to do, but first time somebody comes to a meeting, we're going to pay them some attention. And then after the devotion, after the open discussion, we also ask people to limit their comments. We don't tell our stories in there. And we like some people to share for about 2 to 4 minutes. And if someone comes out with a topic, and this topic's on step 3, they struggle with something, they put that out on the floor again, we address them. We don't let somebody else pick up the start. People with experience, what they just are struggling with, we ask 2 or 3 people behind them just to share. And we don't call them out. We just know. And a lady in there that's struggling with something, and then there'll be a lady that follows in behind and kind of supports her and encourages her. And then at 25 after, we've been doing this a few years now, and it's just been real effective. A lot of people that come in there, I'm going to tell you, it takes courage to come through that door for the first time. And normally I'm going to share. So we have 2 prayers. What we do is we get in a circle. And we just say, if you're struggling with anything at all, just get in a circle. You get in a circle, and we'll all hug. And we'll have somebody lead the prayer for the struggles in there. No matter what the struggle is, we just pray for it. Back up, and in the middle of them, somebody sharing, and they say they're struggling with something, and when you pray for them, yes, we stop the meeting, and we go, and we'll circle around 5, 6, 10 people come, and just pray specifically for something that you're struggling with. And we believe in prayer. And then after that circle breaks up, we all join. We don't hold hands, we hug, and we close the Lord's Prayer. We ask people not to run out immediately after hanging around and fellowship. We got several little handouts, and one of them is this. We call ours RSVP, but it's just, we got some numbers on the inside for newcomers, male and female. We ask the females call females, the males call males. And then on the back, we got a telephone. Just a place for a name and number. We tell people, get you the name and numbers. Call somebody when you get in trouble. A network, we think, one of the most important things in this and recovery. You couldn't do it on your own. You never did. You seek and hear, you come here for help. You need to call somebody. But I don't hesitate a minute to tell somebody, yeah, you do need to call somebody, but the first person you need to call is on the Lord. Hit them needs. it's 2 o'clock in the morning, you think about taking a drink, you call me. Well, I'd like for you to pray for you, call me. Talk to the Lord. Because there's going to come a time when ain't nobody going to be available. And you ain't going to be able to connect with somebody. But there ain't a time in our lives, the rest of our lives, you're going to be able to connect with the Lord. And this is a spiritual prayer step program. We use that's the end of our meeting. I'm going to kind of go right on in and do the...
You can talk about the power of the 12 steps a little bit.
Buddy had asked me to talk about 12 steps. And I'm going to tell you, I am I qualify to go to any AA meeting or any NA meeting. I qualify for both of them. I do like to tell our people, too, when they're going out and seeking meetings, if you go to an AA meeting, you need to identify yourself as an alcoholic. We use the 12 steps. Our version is a little bit different. We use the 12 steps. We have permission to use the 12 steps. But rather than selling alcoholic, we talk about addictions. We don't care what the addiction is. You're welcome to that. But, you know, AA was founded for alcoholics. And the first part is step 1. And the last part of step 12, they're talking about alcoholics. And they have particular, they don't like, but people come in and say they are an addict. So I just encourage everybody, if you go to AA meeting, identify yourself as an alcoholic. If you go to an NA meeting, identify yourself as an addict. Yes, sir.
What about a person doesn't want to say that they're alcoholic, they admit that they're alcoholic? What do you do with someone like that as a minister of the church, a servant of the church?
We don't care. You can come in there and say you're a believer. Now, an AA meeting, they're going to question you. In our area, now, it may not be like that. In Alabama, they're going to question you. And if you don't have a problem, if you don't have a desire to stop drinking, then you need to leave. They're pretty abrupt up there. In our meeting, we don't care. In fact, when I identify myself, I say I'm a believer. My name's Ed, and I'm an alcoholic addict. And some people want to identify themselves as believers. Yeah, this is scripture. We don't care. We just say, some people just say the name. But they get there. And they're there, they got a problem. And they're looking for some solutions. And they're looking for some help. And it takes courage to come in there. And I think the most important thing we need to do is not only give them hope, but make them feel welcome. Man, I'm telling you, our 2 services, you think about somebody that's been out for a while and just doesn't have the courage to even come to a church building. They already strained the relationship. The first thing that ever separated me when I started drinking was the first thing that dropped down in my character was me and my Lord. Did nobody know what I was using? For me and God. And for me to do that, I had to turn my face away from God. And then you just get further and further away from it. So I already struggled with the relationship with God. It took a lot of courage to come in there. They don't want to admit it, that's okay. I just want to come back again. And they keep coming back. Something's going to happen. Something's going to happen. I believe in making meetings. I told them yesterday I'm not anything I'd do, but May the 15th will be 21 years I've been clean sober. But let me tell you, the week before I come out here, went to 3 meetings. I normally go to 4 meetings a week. And I've got a little bit of sobriety, but I believe in these steps. And the only difference in our steps is just a little bit in the Word. And it is true that the 12 steps to recovery and honesty. Okay, we use a recovery Bible. And it's called a Life Recovery Bible. And if you didn't think they got every one of these steps out of the Bible, period, they did. They're one out of this Bible. This is one of the best tools that we use. We study out of this. We have about 15 of these Mark study Bibles. But we've had this program for a while. We are considered part of the mission. We get an annual budget. One thing that we started doing several years ago, if a first-time visitor comes, they're going to get this Bible. And it's going to be signed by someone in our group, and they're going to get a T-shirt. It's got RSVP on it.
What does RSVP stand for?
In recovery, sponsorship, victorious living, and prayer. know, it does not seem like much, but you know, when you got three or four recovery houses coming, there's some people who come to our meeting that one or another of them have a clean shirt. There's some people we pick up, we don't pick them up anymore, did pick up the recovery houses. They're getting there now. But, you know, they wouldn't have one or two shirts. So we always gave them a shirt. And for a long time, I wore the shirt to church on Sunday. Buddy talked about having two meetings, and our second service is in our life center. And I'm going to tell you, that did more good for our RFP program than anything. Because I'm going to tell you, when a man ain't got enough clothes to feel like he's decent to come to church, you're not going to get him in the church door on Sunday. But when we went to this other meeting, this is basically where I go to church on Sundays. My nickname is Short Pants. it's amazing. Buddy talked about changing clothes. Have you ever seen those clips on TV where you stop the world just stop, but you could go on moving around? Buddy only knows one time. Right after we started, I had somebody I'd been working on for a while come to church that Sunday. Buddy come to second service, and he was in that suit. If I could just stop the world, I went there and took that tie and jacket off of him, pulled his shirt out just a little bit. But he does. He still wears socks, but he'll wear loafers. But that's been a blessing. That's been a blessing our church. I'm gonna run through the steps right quick, and I'm gonna tell you. Just some highlights. I want to tell you something about the 12 steps. They are special. Whether you deal with alcohol or drugs or you're just a Christian, these steps are a great way to live your life. There is no perfect way to work these steps. I've never seen two people on the same page at the same time. The most important thing about this is making progress and continue to work them and work them in an order. Being committed. I believe you need to work these steps with a sponsor. My belief. Step one, well, it's 12 steps. We'll break it down. Well, let me tell you real quick my belief. I'm going to tell you, step one, they're real close to baptism. It's the surrender step, surrendering your life. That's the problem. The other 11 steps are the solution. But we go by what we call there's four phases of the 12 steps. The first three is about surrender. It's giving up. Steps one, two, and three is giving up. Step one is admitted we're powerless. And we say over our addiction, we're powerless over our addiction, our life becomes unmanageable. Two, it says, can you believe that power greater than us could restore us to sanity? And that can you believe is a process. It is a process that lasts for the rest of our lives. It's a history. Every morning, you know, I just want a little bit more. But it's a process that even restores sin. Step three said, make a decision, turn our wills and our lives over the care of God. And that's a choice there. But that's why when you ask me how I'm doing, I say, just right. But I'm going to tell you, a lot of days are not going the way I want them to. And I want to tell you, honestly, my will a lot of times is in direct opposition with God's. But if I turn my will, my life over the care of God, whatever happens is going to be just right. It may not be the way I want it. It may not turn out the way I want to. I learned a long time ago. So I don't tell you my problem. I don't tell you. I just say just right. If I am in God's will and He guided me that day, it's going to be all right. End of the day, it's going to be all right. Step four, five, and six is what they call the cleanup steps. And this is where so many people lose. Step four is a courage step, and it talks about made a moral inventory of ourselves.
What?
A moral inventory of ourselves. An inventory. And this is where treatment facilities and people tell us that more people leave after step three. They get some relief from surrendering their lives and for a little while, but then they don't have the courage to go on. When you make an inventory of yourself, and there's examples in Big Book and NA Book, there's outlines, you need a sponsor to guide you this. But when you're, and it's talked about a thorough inventory to see where you're at and what you're struggling with. And it suggests that you put this on paper. It's a lot like our sin. But it's a true inventory of where we're at. And an inventory counts good and bad. It's not all bad. We got good inventory, we got bad inventory. You know, it's just inventory, just see where you're at on point. And that's a courage step. And a lot of people just don't have the courage. I don't mind telling you, when you start addressing some of that old stuff and old behaviors and things we've done, you know, we're not, you know, there's pain in there. There's pain. We got a great way of forgetting about that pain. We can medicate some more. We can stuff it down. We can hide it. But it's just like sin. Mere time does not counsel sin. And mere time ain't going to change a defect. Step five is the easiest step to me. Step four is easy. People get confused on step five. Four, we're worried about sharing on step five, because that's what you do. They say you share on step five. You share. It says, with you, God, and up there for me, God, all you know about what he wants to do is get it out here in the open. And it's a plan, and I'll tell you what. I thought I got some good relief on step one. I thought I got some good relief on step two. I did. And step three, I do it every day. Get relief, but I'm going to tell you what, there was something special after step four. When them secrets got out in the open, step one, I'm going to back up and tell you this, step one, and honestly, step one, I'll tell you what, if they'd asked me and they didn't, I'd make step four the honesty step. You got to be honest about that. If you want to get some relief, you do a step four and five. Do it and then share it with somebody. The same day I did my step five, I went right on into my sponsor told me, he said, I want you to go away and I want you to pray for about an hour. We'll come back and you left out anything. Let's talk about it. If you memorize something, let's talk about it. I went away and come back an hour and we had another hour session. It's easy to memorize and it's easy to leave out one thing. And then after that, he said, I want you to go through step six on your own. He said, you need to pray a little bit. Step six says, entirely ready to have God remove all these character defects. And I thought that'd be easy. I'm going to tell you what, be entirely ready for God to remove everything. I wasn't quite ready to remove everything. I want to remove most of the things. I want to remove the painful things, but I wasn't quite ready to do everything. It's just like when I became a Christian, you know, the last thing that was converted on me was my billfold. I was going along with a lot of them, but it took me, I just didn't know why they had have that much more money. But, you know, to have God be ready for God to move them. And, you know, I still do that step on a regular basis. In the mornings, I'll ask God to do that. And then step seven, humbly ask God. When you're ready, you humbly ask him. Because what our experience has been is this. I can improve my character defects. I can stop drinking for a little while. I can stop some behavior for a little while. But God can remove all I need to improve. Those are that's giving up, cleaning up. When you get to steps 8, 9, and 10, excuse me, 7, 8, and 9, that is when you begin to make up. You begin to make up. Step 8, if you keep your notes on step 4 when you do that moral inventory, you'll be able to use something in step 8, because step 8 is where you make a list of people you harmed and became willing to make amends to those people. Powerful step. This is a step that brings about a lot of pain. Again, you put it in writing, you put down things that you've done to people, and man, most of the things that happened to me was somebody else's fault until I started putting it on paper.
And man, I reversed and how most of those things were my fault. And then step nine is making amends. You go again, you make amends those people in your past. And it don't matter what it is, the only exception that it says it, unless to do so would harm you or others. And most of that is for sexual sin. But still, and again, if you don't do this, it's just still, just again, like the sin. Mere time is not going to counsel. It's going to, and it's a cleansing when you go to somebody. And I'm going to tell you the one most spiritual step for me, because I'm going to tell you what, I'm not a smooth enough talker. I just don't have the proper words to say. I prayed an awful lot. And I'd ask God to prepare your heart when I got to you. Did you hear what I had to say? But he also prepared my heart. And my heart, if I could have undone that and not done that, I would have not done that. And I'm okay with it. That's like a basketball game. But you got to go this person and you got to make the amends the best you can. And if it's a natural amends, you can make they may or may not. They may or may not. You know, you can't control what they do. You got to clean up your side of the street. If they don't accept the call for you, they don't, you know, that's just something they got to do. But what a blessing it is. And step nine may last you forever. People who passed away, my sponsor had me write letters. Just that I'm allowed to get off my chest. Step 10 is a great step. Continue to take personal inventory, like you did in step 4 again. Continue to take personal inventory and make amends right then, that day. If you blow somebody off that morning, you got a chance to accept correctly. That way, you don't have to do step 5 again. You don't accumulate those things. Step 11, softly meditation and prayer to improve your conscious contact with God. That's a special one, too. That's a spiritual step. And that helps you build up that character that we lost, but and build a relationship with God. And then step 12 is have a spiritual awakening and working all these steps. There's just something, there's something spiritual. There's just something spiritual happens. It is a blessing. It's a pink cloud. It is just awesome. And I thought all this time after you got through the 12th step, you graduated. You know, proof. The only people who's in old rooms, and it may be you the starched one that's in old rooms when you came in, you got to be there for when people come in. This is carrying a message of hope. And people don't always need to see, and they do need it. They need to hear it, they need to see it too. My wife is excellent, and let me tell you, whether you're in recovery working these 12 steps, if you have a spouse, or you have a child, there's these 12 steps are probably you too. I mean, you can work those. If you're just a Christian struggling, I mean, you can work these 12 steps. But if anybody's interested in starting a program, you're talking about being blessed. We tell them in the room, you want to get out of self, you start serving somebody else. I don't care how big your church is, unless y'all real different from each side. You got some problems in your church. I say problems, you got some people struggling. Young people, we get more young people addicted to pharmaceuticals, and it's just a need. I don't talk too long. I'm
going to give Barbara the last few minutes, and when she's through, if you want to come get the book, they'll be up here. I'll be in the back for the handouts. But I know Barbara may need to go a couple minutes over time, because I know some important things she wants to share.
If y'all need to leave, that is not going to hurt my feelings, because I know we have run over. But I just want to say that Addiction affects a family so greatly. I'm the granddaughter of an alcoholic. I'm the daughter of an alcoholic. I'm the wife of a recovering addict. I'm also the mother of a recovering addict. And addiction runs deep and wide in our family. And you know, when I got into the rooms of recovery with Ed, I thought it was for him. I got there, you know, hoping to help him, to fix him, and I realized just how sick I was when I got there. And so it does affect all of us. I will never forget one day after we were, Ed and I were leaving church. One Sunday, we had not been going there very long, and as we were pulling out of the parking lot, I happened to see this really nice-looking couple coming down the sidewalk, about in their 40s, and I was just watching them as I was going by, and I turned to Ed, and I said, I believe that man is an alcoholic or an addict, and he said, he looked at the man, and he said, how can you tell? I said, because I looked at his wife, and I saw it in her face, I saw it in her eyes, because I've been that look, and I know that look. And it affects us so deeply. And so many times when people come into, when parents and spouses come into the rooms of recovery, they learn just how sick they are and how much help that they need. And, you know, we call it codependency, and I won't get into all this. I'm not a counselor. I'm not a teacher. I know just from firsthand experience that it does make you sick. You know, they say that the alcoholic loses control of their drinking, and we don't love them. We lose control of our thinking. We become consumed with their every move, with everything that they do. We have to react upon it. We actually become reactionaries. We either overreact or we underreact, but very seldom do we just take good positive action for ourselves because we're so consumed with their lives. And so when family members come in, we talk to them about enabling, and we talked a little bit about this yesterday, about that, about the difference between enabling and helping. And you know, for me, and I told people, enabling so many times feels like love. It feels like we're doing something to help. But it's not. It's hurting them. It's really allowing the addict to continue on in their addiction. You know, if we keep rescuing the addict, if we keep making it paying their bills, bailing them out of jail, whatever it is that that we do that we think we're doing in the name of love, we are really hurting them. If we're always going to be that safe place to land every time they suffer from something, you know, why would they want to lean on God? You know, we need to, there's a saying, to let go and let God, and just to let go of that white-knuckle grip, and just to know that God will help them. I remember one time being in a recovery class, and there was a young man in there, and it was his first time in there, and he was a young man, and the topic that night happened to be on enabling. And I will never forget, I was looking at him, and I could tell that he wanted to say something, and finally he mustered up the courage to speak. And this is what he said. He said, my mom and dad are great people, and they love me, but they have almost loved me to death. And what he meant by that is that they had rescued him on every turn, and he was never allowed to face the consequences of his actions, you know. And then we have people that come in, and they're so full of guilt and shame. And these are not just the addicts. These are the parents, too, that come in into the rooms of recovery. You know, and they feel like they did something to cause it, or they need to be doing something to undo it. And they don't realize that they're not the ones that caused it. They can't cure it. They cannot control it. And so we talk to them about those sort of things. You know, Ed talked about step one being a step of giving up, and it is, but I think of it more being a step of giving in. You're giving in to God, and you're saying that I cannot fix this situation, but you're trusting a God that can. And so we want to talk to the people that come in there about enabling, about detachment, and I'm going really fast here, I know, but one of the main things that we do want to talk to them about is about forgiveness. Because when parents, especially spouses, come in, and I've had the blessing of being able to talk to a lot of women on forgiveness, because that was something that was very hard for me early on. When you come in, when you're married to an addict, I can assure you there is a lot of damage that's done to that relationship. There are a lot of broken homes, broken marriages, broken bank accounts, broken vows, you name it. And addiction causes a lot of brokenness in a family. And so people come in, and they come in, again, thinking that they're coming there for their loved ones. And they start realizing, you know, just how much they need help. How much they need to release that bitterness and that resentment. You know, not so much for the addict, but for them. Because, you know, it keeps us in bondage, or unforgiveness does. And so we have that opportunity to talk to them about forgiveness and about letting go. I know early on, I found forgiving Ed to be very difficult. And to be honest with you, that kind of surprised me about myself, because I thought I was a very forgiving person, a very merciful person. But I found it to be very hard. There was so much damage that was done in our relationship by his addiction that part of me felt like, you know, if I forgave him too quickly, it was kind of making light of the situation, or maybe it was letting him off the hook a little too early or whatever. But, you know, I realized just how sick that caused me and how much in bondage I was for not being able to forgive. And I prayed. I remember reading a story about Joseph and about how he named his son Manasseh, which meant God made me forgive. So I began praying for God to make me forgive, because I was having to forget, because I was having trouble forgetting things. And so I was praying that God would help me to forget these things. And then years later, when God put it on my heart to write this book, I literally had to pray, God, could you remind me of some of this stuff? So I need to write a book about it, and it's not coming to me. And but, you know, even when he reminded me of it, I was at a stage in my life then where I could process some of it even better, and even to be able to forgive anymore. I love the saying by Nelson Mandela where it says, I knew that when I walked out of that jail cell towards my freedom, that if I did not forgive and let go of all the hatred, all the resentment, and all the bitterness, that I would forever be in prison. And that's the way that unforgiveness does us. And so many times, as I said, when people come in there, they don't realize just the help that they need with. So we are in a position, we're not counselors, we're not therapists, we are, the only thing that qualifies us is what God has done in our life. And just to be able to share that message of hope with others, and that's pretty much it. I thank you.